it seems objectively insane. Like,
but then you look, you know, it's like I always like, anytime I think something like that, I think of like something from my culture that looks at like the electric chair. That's an insane thing to do.
To you're not doing it to yourself. With
electricity. No. But we as society are like, when we get and we watch it, and it's like there's this ritual, and you put the hut, and you, like, that's an insane way to roll.
Doom scrolling. That's insane.
That's insane too. But you don't ever think about it that way. So
right.
I don't know. Every time I see something ugly in another culture, I think, what's ugly in my culture?
Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for all the prestigious television. That includes Shogun this week. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back, I guess, if you listen to the preview cast, talk about the first episode of Shogun over on FX Hulu slash Disney. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on over there. It's almost as complicated as this period of Japanese history. What's going on at Disney right now?
Are you saying Mickey Mouse is, in fact, the Shogun of the entertainment world?
He's a wannabe Shogun, I think. Yeah.
A Taiko, maybe?
Yeah, he might be a Taiko. Maybe he rises to that. All right, Aaron. We know a little bit of your history with Shogun. I believe we talked about that in the preview podcast. After digesting the first, actually two episodes, because FX released both of these episodes, one and two, same day. So we've seen them both. But the good news is I don't think there's a lot of like speculation to necessarily be done, especially in this first episode. I don't think it ruins the experience. But we're going to be talking about the first episode here. What'd you think of it?
My experience with Shogun, if you missed a preview, is just by reputation. It's my dad's favorite novel. He loved the miniseries. I did have one enduring memory of this miniseries I completely forgot about until I watched this episode, that of a man being boiled alive in a giant pot. I'll talk about that when we get to that point. But my expectation was this is going to be a very, I had some question marks about some of the actors, the Cosmo guy. I was like, I don't know, this guy might be a pretty boy, lightweight. But I knew the plot was going to be good. The writing was going to be good. It was going to be beautiful. The cinematography is going to be amazing. I mean, just from the trailer and its reputation. Even though having that like pretty high expectations, I was kind of blown away by the first episode. I was in the tank for the show in the first 5 minutes. You start on a wooden sailing ship.
Yeah, I figured.
With shipwrecked sailors taking lead line soundings with broken shell and sand on the bottom. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, this is so cool. And by the end of the first two episodes, I'd already had like six or seven favorite characters. And like, I'm instantly liking some people, and I just thought it was really fascinating, and I wasn't expecting the comedy, like how funny the show can be at times. I wasn't expecting the genuine moments of horror. I certainly wasn't expecting the eroticism that we got. Like these 2 hours are pitching a lot of entertainment heat. It's the only regret I have is it's going to be only a single season. I understand that Clavel made many other works kind of in this area. Maybe they'll adapt some others of those, but I just am now completely relaxed, buckled in to enjoy the ride. How did the first two episodes of Shogun strike you?
These first two episodes were a lot for me to take in. So I really liked the show. I do think the description of, you know, Japanese Game of Thrones is pretty apt here based on what I've seen in the first two. It's interesting because I don't know that I totally follow every tiny detail. And I can't tell if that's a good thing or a bad thing. If that's going to lead me to be a little bit more surprised by the show, or if that's actually going to confuse me and leave me scratching my head.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff in here, not just with the Japanese culture that I don't understand, but also with 1600s Christianity that I don't understand and the machinations there. So I think the show does a fairly good job of cluing you into all that, but this is not a show that holds your hand either. This wants to be Japanese Game of Thrones, right? This wants to kind of show you show you kind of the tip of the iceberg and let you kind of envision the rest of it. And I found it hard sometimes to envision the rest of it, I guess.
I think that, I will echo that, but I thought also because this, unlike Game of Thrones, the central kind of audience POV character is a fish out of water. And I felt like that kind of like only getting to understand every like third or fourth word and kind of like, you know, being immersed, it kind of puts you in that position where it's like, yes, you're playing catch up, but so is John Blackthorne. And he's just desperately trying to go from one thing to another to try to keep a toehold, a finger hold on his destiny, on his fate. And I don't know. I just felt like it was... And
no, that totally works for the Japanese stuff. It's the Christianity stuff. Because he's not a fish out of water in that, right? He is the biggest fish in the sea when it comes to that stuff. He seems to know everything.
But it also would be really stupid if the first time he met a Portuguese, he's like, John Blackthorne, you're swan. He kind of does, but like lays out all the conflicts and stuff. Because they know that. Like why it's
of course,
so that
yeah.
it puts you in the
it's,
place
it's
of
difficult.
The Japanese where they are... Because that's the this is like the outsider being beheld by the outsider and seeing itself.
But neither is an outsider to both, except for me. I am the outsider to
yes.
both. And that is leaving me a little bit confused at times, although I think there's just enough there to grab onto. Like,
but
they do...
You are... I think that John is it represents both that because a lot of what's going on with Spanish and Portuguese is opaque to him too. They've deliberately kept all their dealings in the East as a secret. Yes, the Portuguese and the Spanish know what's going on with them and the Japanese are going on with them, but John Blackthorne's kind of ignorant of both. So,
When they throw out a word like Jesuits and this is not in the first episode, this is in the second, but when they throw out a word like Jesuits, I don't know what implications that has, but John Blackthorne absolutely does.
Sure. And I did. I know the Jesuits by reputation. But I to get to your point, like, yes, all this does remind me of the first few episodes of Game of Thrones, where because I watched the show first, I read the books after the first season, and it's kind of just like, yeah, I don't know everyone's names, I don't know everyone's households, I don't know where everyone's castles are, but I'm like, this is fascinating, and I want to know. Same thing with like The Wire. Like I remember like three or four episodes where it's like, I know that these are the cops and these are the robbers, but
whose corner
is this? There's rival corners and gangs, and there's even rival interdepartmental things, and it's confusing, but manifestly is telling me I'm worth it. I'm worth it. If you invest. This isn't going to be one of those shows where you like get into the lore and you find out there's a whole bunch of like, I don't know, shrugs and question marks. Like this feels like a fully realized world, and Shogun does too, because it largely is based on real world. Like this is lightly fictionalized events of the real life Japanese 17th century. So it checks off all the boxes, and I think this show is going to be, I hope this show is a monster hit for FX Hulu, because it also looks like it cost a bunch of money. And I hate it when a studio commits this much money and then doesn't get rewarded for it, because I'd love for them to do more of these lush, lavish period pieces, because it makes it more likely that HBO is going to pick up the entire Patrick O'Brien, Aubrey Matchard series. And I can retire as a podcaster if I can do 10 seasons of a Patrick O'Brien adaptation. Hell yeah. And I'll drag your ass with me if I have to. But yeah, I'm really excited, man. I was very pleased. This was just easily watchable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I found myself really engrossed in it. I really like, you spoke to kind of like the Game of Thrones, getting to know the houses and stuff. I felt that with the different regents in the Japanese society here, getting to know Torinaga and this Yabushige Yubushige guy.
I call him Yabu, because Yabushige, but yeah,
he's an interesting character.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, Yabushige. Forgive my pronunciation on all of this, because I'm not going to try and say it like a Japanese person would say it. That could be even more offensive. I'm just going to mispronounce everything.
We have thick barbarian tongues, and
we do.
We're uncouth. Yeah. We bait at most once
simple.
A week.
Yeah,
it's a real shit show. So forgive us.
All right. Well, we seems like we both are eager to talk about the episode. Let's get into the recap.
Yeah, let's do it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move. First off, I want to just say, if you didn't look this up, the name of the episode, Anjin, that is just pilot in Japanese, essentially. Which I take to mean navigator. Like, that's the term I'm more familiar with.
Pilot
to me is the guy actually controlling the thing, but I'm thinking
and
of airplanes.
And in this era, they're pretty much one and the same. Like, this is, like, a pilot is a guy who specializes in, like, close inshore piloting. Like, they're expert at knowing where all the depths are in particular harbors, where all the reefs are. They don't necessarily have much to do in, like, blue water sailing, but when you're getting close to the coast, they're indispensable because, you know, it's impossible for every sailor. And usually pilots are also regionally specific. Like, it'd be rare to have, like, a pilot of the world, but this guy seems like he is an expert in, like, trying to be an expert in this region. He's like, you know, the advance brigade of the rest of Europe trying to crack into Portugal and Spain's the entire hemisphere that they own. They think they own.
Yeah, right. And over the course of the episode, you'll understand that you'll come to understand that they're talking about Blackthorn there, because they call him pilot all the time. He's the Anjin. So it's 1600. The Portuguese, we get the title, bunch of title cards here. I'm just going to kind of summarize them. The Portuguese Catholics trade with Japan, but they keep it secret from their sworn enemies, the European Protestants. In Osaka, the Taiko has died, leaving behind an heir too young to rule. So five warrior lords are now trapped in a bitter struggle to become the shogun. And they all kind of sit on a council together. The ship Erasmus, which is John Blackthorne's ship, has been sailing for too long. They're out of food. They're out of water. The captain's at the end of his rope and decides to kill himself, despite his pilot, John Blackthorne, swearing that they're about to make landfall in Japan.
I mean, this captain, I thought, like, because John Blackthorne says, I mean, maybe he thinks he's lying, but he says, I've got white sand at 10 fathoms. That's 60 feet, I think. Like, if you're getting white sand at 60 feet, you are going to hit land. You know, you're getting white, you know, like, that's not something you get in the middle of the fucking ocean. So, like, I thought it was strange that the captain decided to blow his head off, and maybe he's a little deranged. It looks like he's got advanced scurvy.
He's starving. He's not got any water.
Do you think John Blackthorne, like, secretly kept his cache of food? Because he looks remarkably healthy compared to every other sailor.
Right. He's running around. He's fighting when they come to take him away.
Or is he just like, they're like, they refuse to eat his English food? They're Dutchman. He's like, oh, there's plenty of blood pudding over here, guys. Would you like some black pudding? Would you like a boiled baby, perhaps? And they're like, no, we'd rather starve, dude. We're good on all that.
Could be. I definitely took note of that too. But look, he's the main character. What do you want?
It's true.
He's got to be resilient.
He's got to be sexually attractive. You can't have fucked up Austin Powers scurvy teeth. You can't have open boils and wounds. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Mariko's got to plausibly think that this barbarian is something she might want to take a poke at, I think, is where they're going with some of this.
Yeah, we'll see.
They noted each other a lot in the first two episodes for that not to be going anywhere.
All right, sometime later, a Japanese man spots their ship on the coast. Samurai board it, I guess. They're samurai. Find several men, including John, barely alive, and they take the men prisoner. And then we can see them noting, oh my god, cannons and booty. There's so much booty on this ship.
Oh, yeah.
They're pirating the pirates.
As much booty as Toranaga's general's wife's behind.
You can't make jokes that people haven't seen yet, man.
It's true. I spoiled the second episode. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's a good scene. That's a good scene.
And also, like, man, we're just to deal with the text, we're going to be rushing past so many wonders. But like this whole opening act of on the ship and the way this ship slides out of this fog bank as this guy's getting, I guess, water for the morning, you know, filling a bucket with seawater for whatever purpose. It's beautiful. And it's like, also imagine, like, you know, this time where you can just be going about your business and everyday life, and this vast ship just slides out of fog with people that you've never heard of. It's like, man, I don't know. It's a very romantic notion.
I think the there is a certain amount of ignorance of the world in that era that,
yeah, of course,
I think is, yeah, you can romanticize it for sure. There's a lot of space to explore, I guess, right? There are a lot of possibilities there that don't exist nowadays, and of course there are things that exist now in the possibility space that didn't exist then. But
the idea that you can go to a strange new land, meet strange new people, that's a start. That's something that we might have 1,000 years from now if we figure out warp drive. Sure. But for right now, it's just like, that's, we can't relate. Like, the closest thing would be an alien invasion, which is science fiction. So, but it's it is very cool. Like, that's the idea that this, like, this time period is just crackling with possibilities and dangers, is just such a inherently cool concept.
Yeah, I don't know. Personally, I like watching TV from the comfort of my very warm living room, as opposed to getting on a ship and going to a foreign land.
No, I mean, it's romantic doesn't necessarily always mean positive. It's just like, yeah, it's also scary that, like, a ship full of barbarians can just pull up on your shore. And start shelling you. That's also just like, you know, it's scary when in Independence Day the aliens come in and start blowing up our ship. Like, but it's not boring, is what I'm saying.
It's not boring, that's for sure. All right, we meet a couple of people here. A man named Yoshi Toranaga and his son. And his son is showing off his pet bird to his father, who's impressed with the bird's hunting skills. And they arrive at Osaka Castle, where they're greeted by Lord Ishido and his council, who seem to think this is the end of Toranaga. We'll get to the meeting here in a second, though. I like this bird scene because it immediately tells me what kind of a man Toranaga is. He doesn't admire the beauty of the bird. He doesn't admire its speed. What he admires is its deceptive capabilities. It hides itself, cloaks itself in the sun, out of which it can attack. That, to me, tells me that he appreciates the deceptive hunter.
And it's also going to kind of give you an insight in how he's going to wage his personal struggle against these other lords. Like, he's
exactly
going to conceal his true intentions, conserve his energy, wait for the right moment. Yeah, and it's also like it. I listened to the official podcast where the bulk of it was an interview with Sonata, and, you know, his, you know, the fact that he was a producer and personally involved in, like, all the accuracy of this and his falconing and his horse riding lessons. And he talked many times about, like, really being a stickler for getting, like, the customs of the dress and the precise movements. And I thought it was interesting because I listened to that podcast and watched the episode again. You can see it all there. Like, watch how
Toranaga interacts with his son, with his falcon, and how relaxed and at ease he is. And in the next scene where he's on his horse riding to go see Ishido, he's like just ramrod straight. And like his, like the way he's riding a horse is almost like symbolic. Just like precise positioning and just ramrod straight, and how he, his men file through the castle and take their position before the lords. It's just really cool. And it feels important. Even if you don't understand what's going on, it lends like subconsciously this gravitas to everything. This formality,
the ritual.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. It feels like there's an import to everything. Especially this next scene where Toranaga meets with the council who accuse him of consolidating his power and holding the mother of the heir hostage in his land. He denies it, of course, like you do. The council has voted to demand Lady Ochiba's return, and he has 7 days to comply. And one of Toranaga's underlings, this guy named Tadayoshi, can't bear the insult of the accusations. So he tries to stand up for his lord and ends up embarrassing himself. And so he pledges to commit seppuku, ending his family line.
This is all true.
This is an accurate description of what happens in the scene. I like the kind of lead up to this scene too, with Hiramatsu, this guy, we don't really know his name yet, but he's talking about Osaka. He says, I hate Osaka, this place, it's become a shithole. And you don't get the full majesty of it until the end of this episode,
right?
But you get a glimpse of Osaka. Osaka doesn't look like a shithole. Nothing about what I've seen here looks like a shithole. He's describing not the place, but the people, the government, the regents here.
Yeah, that they're like, you know, broadly seen as these ineffective bureaucrats, and they're the real warriors. And it seems like that they maybe, I don't know, this might be wrong, but my idea is that Toranaga and his men are more pastoral. Like, they like being out in their fiefdoms, and it's probably not as built up and urban. But yeah, I thought this, my understanding of this is that they're framing like Toranaga as a little bit like Yabushiga, in that I think he knows that the things he's doing are provocative. Just like Yabushiga knew that if his lord ever found out that he's trying to steal these cannons and the ship and stuff, that it would be. But when he's called on it, he does the like, oh, so sorry, you know, I didn't have any, that's just my daughter's mother, and you know, they're having a birth here, and there's plausible. Mm-hmm. It just, he's quite a bit better at it than Yabushiga. But I got this idea that maybe that's why they're like lord and underling, is that there is kind of like they both have like a similar manner of moving. I mean, the Yabushiga obviously is a lot more morally dubious. Toranaga just seems like he's like this paragon of virtue.
And all of that makes me wonder about his intentions. He's a man who appreciates, let's say, deception, right? A man who works in the shadows. He later in this episode will claim that he has no ambition to be shogun. He does not want the title or the job. But yet, I think it's accurate, like what you said, he is consolidating power. And that forces me to ask, for what reason? If you don't want the job, what reason are you consolidating power for? And to me, that answer doesn't come until episode 2. But
right,
there is a definitive answer there, and it's not to become shogun, at least in my mind.
And even then, it's like there's like, you know, the three hearts, like which of his hearts
exactly
is being revealed in his motivations. Like, yes, he does have fondness for his lord, and yes, he probably does want to kind of, you know, be like a Maximus type from Gladiator, where he just wants to see the realm through this particular period and then put the kid on the throne and then go back to his fiefdom. But yeah, like it's one of those things where you wonder, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy where the old man's like, I'm worried that these guys are going to kill my son. I want you to be, you know, and he refuses that. So it's like, well, we'll have this council of five lords. And Tokunaga decides to start consolidating his power to protect the boy.
but that makes his other regents suspicious and try to move again. So it's like, we're early on that I don't know that this isn't kind of like a tragedy where the old man's private concerns might have caused this kind of like, you know, like Alexander the Great's empire fell apart after his death. Like, was that inevitable because these are just ambitious, greedy men, or does some of this stuff kind of like brought upon itself?
Yeah, it's a fair question. There's a chicken and egg problem here. Is the consolidation of power the cause or the effect? It's tough to say, for
sure.
But
there's also, did you catch this Minowara business?
They'll explain it a lot more in episode two, but yeah.
Yeah, that this guy is like almost, not quite, because obviously this is all magic stuff, but like in Lord of the Rings, Aragorn, you know, has got this magic blood. He's descended from this long line of ancient, well-respected kings. And Toranaga has that kind of blood, like the blood of the last clan that was like the shogun. Mm-hmm. Which, do you know what a shogun is? Because I didn't.
I mean, not in specific terms. I know it's obviously a ruler in Japan.
Yeah, so Japan's had an emperor this entire time and will all the way up, I mean, to current day. They have an emperor. But at various times...
England has a queen.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And, yeah. And so during the periods of the shogunate, the emperor's power kind of wanes, and these guys are the supreme military dictators. And shogun, I think, literally translates to, like, the military... supreme military ruler appointed by the emperor as defender against the barbarians. And it's a title that was first like established when Japan was started to go war against the Koreans and the Chinese. But it also, like, I guess there's like three or four different shogunate periods, and some of them had more power or less power, but the bottom line is Toranaga descends from one of those very first like revered powerful shoguns, and I think that's another reason the other lords are kind of wary of him. Like, he's got the magic blood, he's the everyone thinks he would make a great king. Oh shit, what if he becomes a king, you know?
Yeah, if he says the word, people will follow him. That's what they're scared of, I think.
Yeah, yeah, and that's like just like in Game of Thrones, like who has the power? Does the king have the power? Do the priests have the power? Like ultimately, who has the power is when you call banners, which one has the most to show up?
Right. Yeah, and it seems like there are a lot of banners consolidating under Toranaga. I appreciated how good of a diplomat he also is. There's a lot of dialogue in this that really just sings. When they accuse Lady Ochiba of being a hostage in his land, he says she's no more a hostage in my castle than I am here in this one, which I mean, they don't want to give up the game yet.
The hut,
so
yeah.
They can't say, yes, in fact, you are a hostage and we're going to kill you tomorrow or seven days from now.
Even though that seems like an open secret that they both understand.
Yeah.
But if they ever spoke it out loud, the trap would have to instantly spring. And that's why... You know, one of the reasons he's so frustrated with Tadayosha is that he's trying to, you know, he's playing that diplomatic game. And by saying you've done this outrage against our lord, he's like, how dare you say that he insulted me? When did he call me a traitor? No, he was just asking questions. And
when he plainly did call him a traitor, I mean, there's hardly any insinuation there. It's almost just spoken, but.
Yeah.
Like, but Tadayoshi is right, but also he's wrong to speak up at this moment.
Yeah, and it seems like Toranaga also is maybe constantly frustrated by his underlings. Like, he's so smart that his underlings don't understand. Because, like, you know, I think that Hiromatsu guy, who is intriguingly has a surname of Iron Fist in the cast descriptions.
Okay.
He's Toda Iron Fist Hiromatsu. So, like, I can't wait to see this guy be a badass, because he kind of, you can see it at the margins, like when he does that sword pop in this episode when he confronts Yabu.
Even he
just doesn't understand. And nobody gets, like, why? Like, this is an obvious trap. Why are you walking to it? But he understands that, like, if he goes to war, he can't beat these other four guys.
Yeah, they're all allied against him, so he needs to break that alliance before he can stand a chance.
it's interesting because, like, in Game of Thrones terms, it seems like they're almost like he's the love child of Ned Stark and Tywin Lannister. He's got Ned Stark's, like, nobility and honesty and decency, but he's also got Tywin Lannister's, like, just cunning eye for power and how to navigate it.
Seems like it. So after this meeting, Toranaga and Hiramatsu discuss the outburst from Tadayoshi. And Toranaga promises to spare Tadayoshi's wife, Fuji, who is also Hiramatsu's granddaughter. And they also discuss this predicament that they're in with the other regents. Toranaga doesn't want to be here, but he can't go to war with four armies, or like we said, he'll surely lose. So he sends Hiramatsu to Ajiro to investigate the ship that was washed ashore. Boy, at this point, I'm thinking... I'm wondering how a society that routinely ends bloodlines at the slightest faux pas survives. Like, maybe this is why Japan has a depopulation problem right now. But it's insane to me that can, like, end a bloodline because you made a simple mistake. I mean,
yeah.
If I was killed every time I made a mistake, I would have died 1,000 deaths.
Sure. And I think some of this is a little romanticized because my understanding is that, like, yes, this definitely happened. This was part of the culture, but it also was something that was extremely romanticized by the Japanese themselves. Because, like, man, how much more romantic? You love your lord so much that when you disappoint him or to spare him from dishonor, you kill yourself. You give yourself. And this highly ritualized, beautiful, where you'd compose a death poem, and, like, no matter what you did in life, you can do that and retain honor for your family, which is important. But with, like,
family, if you're ending your bloodline,
it was something that, like, was like, yeah, it definitely happened, but it was a rare thing. And then in the retelling, like, future generations will be like, you know, we're soft. Our grandfathers used to off themselves at the top of a hat, and we're soft. We don't do that. And, like, that is repeated and repeated and repeated till you get to, like, World War II. And, like, that's, like, the mass scale glorification of, like, you know, you've got whole divisions of soldiers and airmen and navy that's willing to die for the emperor, you know, to sacrifice their lives. So it's like, it's almost like one of those, I'm trying to think of the way we romanticize the West and the gunfighters of the West is a lot of why we are the way we are in 21st century America. But if you do any research, those gunfighters are not all, like, they mostly just murder drunken people and not even that many of them. Like, it's like, this is the exception of the rule, and now we talk about it as if that's, like, everybody went into the cities healed and were ready to draw down and it becomes stupid, you know?
Yeah, every single poker game ended in a murder, right?
Right, right. So, and also trying to live up to that extreme view of your own history turns it into, like a toxic mess. So, it is wild that, like, this guy, for a pretty minor slight, but also this is a very critical period. Like, this is like the Cuban Missile Crisis of their day. Mm-hmm. So if you are, you know, there's good reason to be making these crazy, well, it seems to us from, I guess, the Western perspective, these crazy, deals and offers and just playing with your life.
Yeah, I don't know how much Tadayoshi knows about any of this stuff, though. He doesn't seem like the brightest bulb in the bunch here, but anyway, inside their cage, Blackthorn tells his men that they have reached Japan and they can open trade with the Japanese as long as the Portuguese don't realize who they are. And they won't realize who they are as long as they don't find this rudder, which is locked up in the captain's quarters. Now, I was under the impression that a rudder was a part of the ship.
I found out about, because this is like 200 years before I get involved in the age of sail. But this rudder is a very archaic form to, like, talk about a logbook. And it's like, it's a corruption of the French word for routier, which is essentially like a book of routes.
Yep.
So they call it the rudder, R-U-T-T-E-R, and the R-U-D-D-E-R is the thing at the back of the ship that steers the boat. But I was okay. I was like, what the a rudder? How the fuck is finding a rudder going to do anything? And why are you locking it in your cabin? Is it like,
right.
You know, like some people, I guess, take their steering wheel to keep their car from being stolen. Like you go to the dock, you just take your rudder. Yeah, they can't take the ship if they don't have the rudder. But it's just a logbook.
Yeah, and the episode makes that clear contextually over the course of the first couple of episodes. So wasn't that confused for very long, but...
And we know why they are so concerned, because if they start reading that rudder, it's going to be obvious that they're no simple merchantmen. They're privateers.
Yeah,
there's a difference.
I suppose so.
There's a difference.
I suppose so. Privateers go around stealing silver and gold and...
Yeah, they have permission.
Guns, right?
They have permission by a certain by a king or a queen. if you're on the other side of that, they're just pirates,
right? So Fuji refuses to let them take her infant son and ritually kill him. This is Tadayoshi's wife. She puts a knife to her own throat to try and keep him safe. And a little woman named Marika eventually talks her into going along with the ritual.
Yeah, and we'll come to understand that she has a similar, like when she says, I understand, I feel the pull of death like you do. And we don't understand exactly why, but something happened to her father 16 years ago. Some kind of dark betrayal that made her want to follow her father in death, and she was forbidden to do so. So just like, and it seems like the politics here is this Iron Fist guy is sufficiently powerful enough, and this is his favorite grandchild, that he's like, look, I get it. Tadayoshi is an idiot. He's got to die, and his idiot son's got to die. But like, could you spare my grandchild? And the Lord is trying to like make the best out of this. But like, that's what I'm saying. Like, there's a couple moments of genuine horror, but like being in the mother's position where she's going to deliver her truly innocent, like a baby, to the father to be ritually slaughtered is wild. And I really felt for her when she draws her sword to like, nah, you can't make me. You can't make me stay here.
Yeah. And especially the fact that she's going to have to live with it after, right? She's going to survive all of this is almost worse in a way.
And when we see later on in this next scene where she goes back to her quarters to pray, we find out she's a Christian, and this weighs on her. The fact that she's condemning, you know, she knows the pain and the shame she's condemning this woman to live with, and she, you know, asks God for mercy, not just for, you know, just for herself, but also just like, what a fucked up situation. Like, I assisted Lady Fuji with her grief, but like, did I really?
They're doing a good job of showing the like conflict in this two hearts situation that she talks about later. Because when you look at the very first scene of this episode, it's a man killing himself. And John Blackthorne's estimation of that is that's the coward's way out. You're doing something that God doesn't approve of, right? Mm-hmm. And so now when you see Mariko living like one foot in each of these worlds, she's absolutely torn because her culture thinks this is right and proper. Her religion thinks this is an abomination. So
it's also
see the conflict in her.
There's a lot of these cultural inversions, and not just in terms of hygiene and grooming, but like John Blackthorne being like, you know, suicide is the worst thing you can do. You're going to go to hell. Whereas in Japan, it's actually worse to be ordered to live with shame and dishonor.
Right.
Like death is like the easy way into the
and
the
she's doing
lands,
both here. Is the thing, right? Like she's condemning Fuji to this life of dishonor, and then she's also condemning this child to death. So like,
it's the worst of all her worlds.
That's rough. Lord Yabushige and his army arrive in the village where the prisoners are being held. Blackthorne is dragged out of his cage to try to communicate with him, but he can't behave himself and he gets pissed on for it. Literally.
Not very good at parlaying.
Aside from this is just a crass, brash, simple-minded idiot who we'll see is actually not the case come, future scenes. I don't understand his demeanor here. I understand he thinks these are savages. They're less than human. But he is so clearly outmatched here that he should at least show a little respect for the situation he's in, if not the people or the animals, whatever he would call them, that are doing this to him.
This is true, but especially on second watch, I got the idea, because the first time I'm watching, I'm like, oh my God, are you trying to get beheaded? Are right. you like, because it seems like he knew better. Like, he's like, knows that, like, hey, I got to play this right when I'm going up the staircase. Right. And I don't want my men to kill anybody. But then as soon as he gets personally disrespected, he's all like, oh, you whore spun, cocksucking, piss beggar. And right. then he gets pissed on. But I think that, like, if he had kept that meek attitude, like him going and grabbing the priest's cross and trampling on it, which we're about to see. Like,
no,
if he hadn't
no,
done
later,
that, he's a
sense.
Dead man. So it's like. Uh-huh. He's the type of guy who puts himself at maximum risk, taken to the very edge of being executed. But if he was a guy like me, or probably like you, we would have survived to, we wouldn't have been near that point, but we would have been executed yeah. as a matter of course when the Portuguese just asked him to. Like,
I understand that
you
scene.
Besides Shiga. Yeah,
I just don't get this scene. Like,
no,
he's not saying these Portuguese suck and I hate them and they're my enemies. He's yeah. saying, you guys are. I piss on this whole damn country. It's.
But
I mean,
he's
obviously they can't understand.
He's not a rational guy. Like, throughout the whole episode, he's yeah. just like, I can't die here. I just can't. And everyone's saying, no, dude, you totally can.
Absolutely.
It's entirely likely you're going to die. No, I just can't. And
yeah, where do you think these guts that they dumped on you came from? Like, it's probably the people they beheaded.
Yeah, that looked foul. That's some crazy riot control stuff they got there, but
yeah.
But in the yeah, like in also like in Japan, you must be good. Like that's the highest. Like even when you lords are openly conspiring against your face, you have to be polite and you have to be deferential and you have to be honorable. And it's not at all the English way.
No.
I tell you, I want to talk about Cosmo Jarvis because I talked some shit about him in the preview podcast and I thought like he was going to be the weak link. He's going to be this pretty boy. I did not expect, like, calling it a poor man's Tom Hardy is disrespectful to what he's doing here. He is like a sure. very well off upper middle class, lower upper class, 501k maxed out. Broad diversity of wealthy man's version of Tom Hardy. Like, I kept on thinking, if this was actually Tom Hardy, would it be better? And I'm like, I don't think it would be.
No, I mean, he's doing a great job. I'm believing his portrayal of this character as someone who is brash and foul-mouthed and everything they say he is, but he's also more than that. He's got a
curiosity and a cunning, and yeah. you can see how he's going to probably learn and take a few things. And like, you know, you also see other Europeans like the Rodriguez we'll get to where
oh,
you know,
yeah.
he makes this point. It's like, you know, go and look at this city and tell yourself then that we're at the hilt of civilization. Like you can already see like he's going to have this path of, you know, this journey of like understanding, respect and.
Oh, yeah.
I will say this about him, though. I didn't notice this the first time through because I was very impressed with him. But someone pointed out on, I can't remember if it was our Discord or the subreddit, that he's wearing quite terrible blue contacts. And
oh.
I cannot unsee it. I cannot unsee it. He's wearing, all, especially in these bright daylight scenes, he's just wearing shit blue contacts, man.
Okay, I didn't notice.
It's Yellow Jackets all over again, man.
okay. All right, I'll have to look at his eyes. Let's go over to Blackthorn being taken before Yabushige. He immediately outs himself as a pirate. The Christian Catholic, should I say, translator begs Yabushige to execute him, but he won't do it. And instead, Yabushige tells the priest to select another hostage to execute.
There's a couple things I was impressed by. Number one, I just instantly like this Yabushige guy. He's very challenging to like because he's also kind of a monster, but he's—I don't know—there's just something about him that's very charming. He's got a, I guess, a lack of reserve that the rest of the Japanese actors, you know,
absolutely.
Like the annoyance, the open annoyance he flashes at this man's religiosity, you know, it's like, I don't got time for your Christian bull. Like, you don't see that in any of the other samurai. And Yabushige kind of, I don't know, he's like a Joe Pesci Goodfellas type where he's clearly unstable and crazy, but also a lot of fun.
Uh-huh. That's what I kept looking for in this series, is somebody with personality, right?
Yeah. And he's smart.
That isn't super buried. And yeah, he was one of those people.
And he's also smart because, like, his eyes really clicked when he sees this man disrespect his cross. He's shrewd enough to know, oh my God, this is a white man who's not like the other white men. That's interesting.
Yeah, he is very smart. He'll display those smarts here in a bit, a little bit more.
I also really
like this guy too.
This backwater village priest, like, he's not nearly as good at speaking Japanese, so he's like speaking like a 5-year-old. Like, this man, pirate must die. It's and you can see that, like, you know, Yabu is just like, this, like, I'm just judging degrees of barbarians here, man. This guy smells like piss. Yeah. This guy doesn't, but he talks like a 5-year-old. This guy doesn't talk at all.
Oh, he does try and talk. That's the thing that's hilarious to me. He does the foreigner thing, right, where he just speaks loudly and slowly and thinks that's going to somehow make them understand his stuff, or intensely. Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter how forcefully you say your name and your mission, they still can't understand you, you dumbass.
Yeah, but that he grabs that guy's cross and stamps it in the mud and says, I will not be spoken by Catholics. Yeah, that's like all of them did. You can see, like, this is, you know, because they understand, like, they don't believe. Well, I guess some of them do, but the majority of the Japanese don't believe in this god, but they understand that this is, like, holy, and it's a religious thing, and, you know, there's a certain amount of respect to it, and this guy just stamping it into the mud makes a big impact.
The confusing thing, I guess, to me here is this is the exact opposite of the plan that he described to his men down in the prison hole. He told them, we need to just play our cards right and pretend like we're Catholics, I think. And then we'll get out of this safely and we can trade with these people and just be gone.
I think he was out surprised by the speed at which they had to translate. Because, again, they don't know anything about. They know that Spain and Portugal's up to something, but I don't think they suspect how well they penetrated. And when it's clear that,
yeah,
like, what a helpless feeling to be, you know, this is like Ace Ventura, where he's got a translator and everything's like, oh, it's white devil this, white devil that. It's like, I can't help but notice you keep using white. Oh, it's just how they know you. Like, you're just completely at this guy's mercy. Yeah. He's clearly bad faith, clearly trying to get you killed. I think so. His plan had to change.
Yeah, but it changes the instant he sees this guy. I mean, his first words out of his mouth are like, you're disgusting. I hate you.
How's he gonna pretend to be Catholic when here is a Catholic Protestant priest right in front, or I'm sorry, Catholic Portuguese priest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, if he would, I mean, imagine if he sticks with the plan. Oh, I'm the same as this guy. Bullshit. You speak with an English accent. No, yeah. I thought it was him thinking quickly on his feet, which he does a bunch in these two episodes.
And he also understands here that his takeaway from this conversation is, oh, the Japanese actually don't know about anybody other than the Portuguese.
Right.
So that'll become valuable later.
It's an opportunity in the crisis.
So Torunaga plays games with the heir, who is privileged not to be a hostage as a child. And one of the heir's guardians worries about Ishido's plans to take over and kill the heir. And she wants him to exploit his bloodline and become the next shogun, but he claims, nope, I don't want to be a shogun.
And she, I also like the scene where she takes him to this tree that was planted the day the boy was born, and you can see it's very weak and has to be supported to keep from growing correctly. And she asks him, like, you know, you are this boy's support. What happens if you die? You know, so he's like, kind of like, yeah, you don't want to play the game. Great. You're going to shame your lord and disobey his last order. So it's faceted, because do you believe that nothing in Torunaga wants to be shogun? Is he truly like a Cincinnatus kind of figure? Or
I'm suspicious that that is not true, but I also don't know if given the opportunity, he would actually take it. I think even if he desires it, I don't know that he's the guy who would actually snatch that power.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because I have not delved a lot into feedback or haven't been spoiled yet. So I can't promise that with the nature of feedback going forward. What's your gut tell you at the end of this thing? Is Torunaga going to be shogun, number one? And number two, will he be protecting the heir? Or you understand that he's going to murder the... Or will the heir be murdered... Yeah, I guess here's the propositions I have. Will he be shogun?
Mm-hmm. Will the heir still be alive? And if he's not alive, will he have been murdered by Torunaga's actions or direct inaction?
My gut tells me, based on what I've seen of Torunaga, that he's the smartest man in the room. That doesn't always win the day, but you've got better than even chances if that's the case. So I assume that Torunaga is going to succeed in his mission to keep the heir alive long enough to become the next Taiko or Shogun or whatever.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's my assumption, but that's only based on what I've seen of the character so far. I don't know any of the history.
Yeah. I don't either. Like, I bet the kid, the heir, ends up dying so that they do have a he does have a clear path to go to Shogun, but it will be because of the machinations of Shido and the rest of the lords. It'll be something he reluctantly does as vengeance for his lord more than his own personal glory and honor.
Okay, could be.
But we'll see. We'll see.
So a hostage is dropped into a pot of water that is being slowly heated. And over the course of the night, he's boiled alive as Yabushige waits and watches for the moment of death. He's disappointed by the man's inarticulate death, but less so by the sex that his courtesan Kiku and his servant have for his pleasure.
I like when he sees his lieutenant like looking at the woman. He's like, "What are you looking at with your pervert eyes? Just fucking with this guy."
Yeah, that's pretty good.
This boiling alive scene, so it's funny. I remember this from the original miniseries. This is one of my enduring memories, and I completely forgot it until it was happening. Like, oh my god, this is where this memory came from, and it's for this show. Huh. The other interesting thing to me was that I remembered it in my head as being very graphic. Like, not this graphic, but like the man clearly in the water, screaming, thrashing around. And I looked up the scene from the original miniseries, and it's like this man gets pulled and he's screaming, he's led to this cauldron, but it cuts away before you see him. It's like my childhood brain invented all of the actual horror of being boiled alive. But I remember I was like this is in 80, so I was like 5 years old. I remember, like, that's the first time I'd ever, like, oh my god, can you, like, my mom has told me, like, how bad it would hurt to put your hand on a hot stove. Like, what if you're thrown into a fucking boiling pot of, holy shit, that's terrible, you know? Yeah. Like,
yeah, that's horrible.
And this is the R-rated version of that. Like, this guy looks like a pork roast that's been in a slow cooker for 12 hours because he literally is. Like, it's the meat is falling off the bone and it's hideous.
Yeah. To the point where he kills himself, I think, right? He smashes his own head on the side of this iron pot.
Yeah.
Just to end the pain. I feel like if Yabushige really wants people to be articulate when they die, he might want to try less painful ways of killing them.
True.
But, I don't know. But he's obsessed with...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm trying to figure out who Yabushige is. What he wants out of this. Because clearly he is fascinated by observing people's reactions to the world and circumstances, right? I mean, that's why Kiku decides that this is actually what's going to get him going. He might be bored if I just try and have sex with him, but if I present him with something interesting to watch and observe, that will really titillate him. And yet at times he seems a little dim, or maybe not at least as smart as the smartest people in the room, but
so he seems like, so I got a very strong kind of Littlefinger vibe where this is like, I guess there's something about Yabushige. I think it's his manners. It's his dress is not as precise. His hair is not. He's like the shabbiest of the samurai lords. And that to me tells me that he's kind of relatively new. And this could all be wrong because I don't know. Sure. And please don't tell me either, because I'm trying to enjoy this as it is. But like that he has come like Littlefinger from nothing. And he's worked his way up through grit and determination and cleverness. But he's also frustrated because he thinks he's probably as smart as the five regents, but he just can't get there because he is uncouth. He doesn't have the Minowara bloodline. He, you know, and I wonder if that's why he's hitched his wagon to Torunaga, because the show is asking me to ask, why is this kind of guy who Torunaga kind of makes fun of and doesn't trust? Like, why does he seem so loyal to him? And I think it's because he knows Toranaga probably is going to be the one that wins this. But I don't know. He also could be a Littlefinger type, and that he's just a complete shit and he changes course on a dime. And I just
climbing the ladder. Sure.
I just like I said, his morals are terrible, but he's just a fascinating and really likable character. One of my early favorites. Yeah.
He seems to want to be a philosopher of some kind.
He's also there's also this Roose Bolton quality to him. Like, you know, that was one of Ned Stark's bannermen, and you're always like, why is this guy who skins people alive and has got this lunatic son, why is he one of Ned Stark's bannermen? And there's a little bit of that. Like, there's a disreputable quality. He's like the one down from all the other lords, but yet he's this seems stalwart ally of the paragon of virtue. What the fuck is up with that?
Well, he's also a greedy opportunist as well.
True.
Which we'll see here later in
maybe
the episode.
Maybe this Ned Stark is smart enough to know he needs a few of those around to shore up his weaknesses. Like, I need a complete scumbag so that I don't get blindsided by other scumbags.
Mm-hmm. We'll see. Blackthorn wakes naked and hungry. Food has been provided, but no clothes. This is one of the moments of comedy in the series. Where he's standing at the door, his hands over his crotch, completely bare-ass naked, and he says, where are my boots?
Yeah. Not knowing that you're never going back to your Western clothes, dude. And he asked for boots.
He's completely stark naked, and he's, like, concerned about where his boots are. That's hilarious to me.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
So Yamashige demands that his nephew write a poem about the man who died the previous night. And he does, and Yamashige is pleased with it. Poem being, his eyes were just the end of hell, all pain articulate. He was not
it's
articulate.
Funny. That's what I'm saying. Like, I thought it was this another calculated, like, going against the Lord, but to stand out. Like, I thought that when his mother's like, look, your uncle's coming, and you got to make a big impression. And as they, and the way he looked, like, I'm like, oh, this is a weak kid that's going to get rolled over by this Lord. And then when I see, you know, Yabu kind of rolls into the scene, I see what kind of guy he is. I'm like, oh, this guy's going to be strung up with his guts out. But sure. He does take these risks where, like, he definitely goes against what, you know, like, he's like, it's an inarticulate death, but he has this, like, poetic way of elevating it, and it really impresses and delights Yabu.
And I think there's an acknowledgement here on Yabushige's part where he understands that this guy is just trying to dress up this event that he saw no value in, but he's doing it in order to please his uncle, right? And so he appreciates that.
Yeah, and there's this term that, like, I can't quite precisely define. Maybe you've heard of panache. Have you ever heard that word, panache?
Sure. I equate it to, like, a certain flair to your actions.
Yeah, but there's also, like, a bravery and a brashness and, like, a swashbuckling. And I think that Yabushiba really admires this man's panache, even though he knows he's just kind of glad-handing him. And he's genuinely impressed with this kid's ability to, you know, like, he clearly, because Yabu's getting ready with his calligraphy. He's like, you know, kind of like, you know, has these appetites of an artist above all else. And this guy's got this artistic talent, and he's got a mind for, like, military and strategy and politics. He's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about that. Blackthorn gets dressed by a couple of women who leave him alone again. And then we go over to Yabushige and his nephew. Nephew gets his fief raised, which is basically his holdings, his pay.
Not only that, I also found out that the importance of the lords are ranked strictly by their koku allowances. So it's not just like how wealthy you are, but that's literally your prestige as well. It's just an ordered list of who's got the most to who's got the least, and you just got 3,000 more, young man.
Yeah, seems good. So the nephew asks if he's going to tell Tornaga about the ship. Yabushige kind of encourages him to think of a reason why he would not. And the nephew's reasoning, there will be war, and Ishido will become powerful in Japan, but he'll have to contend with Christian weapons. And anybody who has Christian weapons with which to defend themselves would become a valuable ally. There just so happen to be Christian weapons on this ship.
Yeah.
And Yabushige is all set to, you know, keep this a secret and trade this information and these guns later, but Hiramatsu arrives, claims the weapons for Lord Torinaga, and Yabushige realizes there must be a spy in this village because he knew exactly how many guns and cannons there were.
It's also my understanding, this is something that I guess the old miniseries kind of played up, is that that, like, guns and cannon are like these magical weapons that the samurai didn't even understand, which I hear is anachronistic, that the Japanese have been making guns for like 100+ years.
Yeah.
But because of the metallurgy of Japan, they cannot quite manufacture on the scale and quality that the Europeans. Because if you know anything about, like, katanas and how they're made, you know that they're, like, made by folding steel and folding steel and folding steel, and that, like, makes it super strong and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the reason they came up with that technique is because their metal quality was so bad that they had to have all these, like, advanced techniques to make swords that were decent. So it's like, my understanding is, like, it's not that they don't know what guns and cannons are and they need to be, it's just that, like, they just, you know, like, a European ship could bring in 1 month what they could produce in 10 years. So it's like a balance of power thing rather than
oh, the mystical weapon from the Westerners kind of thing.
All right. Yeah, more guns, the better.
Because I even like a lot of the, if you notice in the background, a lot of these samurai guards have rifles already.
Uh-huh. The thing that stuck out to me here is when Hiramatsu sort of checks the loyalty of Torunaga here, or he's not really checking the loyalty. He's enforcing loyalty, I guess, mm-hmm. At sword point here. Because this is an interesting conflict, right? You've got this fief idea, which is lower lords being loyal to the higher lords because they are paying them, essentially, or giving them lands or whatever belongs to them in their fief. But then you've got the concept of loyalty. You're supposed to trade that stuff in exchange for loyalty. Now, those concepts, I feel like, are dubious at best. And you have Yabushige here kind of displaying that. If he thinks he has the upper hand and an advantage over the higher lord who he's loyal to, that loyalty could go out the window.
Yep.
Assuring loyalty by payment only gets you as far as somebody else paying them more.
No, I mean, this is literally gangster shit. This is The Sopranos, where, you know, Tony and the Bud, there's like a give and take, where it's like the bosses can take as much as they want, but if they take everything, then the underlings will betray them. So,
and this is the entire country being run this way. This is not pockets of underworld.
This is feudalism. Yeah, it's like, and there's like this push pull between the lords. Like, I can pull the chain so tight, but if I do it a little tighter, then the dog will break the chain and, you know, destroy me. And especially if multiple dogs get together.
Or maybe I can pay them more, and the chain will become stronger, you know?
Stronger, right. Yeah. But just like, you can tell. And like, I just love that scene where Hiramatsu, the Iron Fist, rolls up, and he's kind of catches Yabushige red-handed. And he tries to protest, like, oh, this is my fief, I thought. And he, like, oh, I thought, you know, I'm so sorry. I thought you were loyal to my lord. And he does that little, like, pops the sword, like, a half inch out. And Yabushige is like, he does the math and is like, fuck, okay, no, I'm going to give this, I just want to make it a surprise, you know?
Yeah, right. Nobody's buying that.
It's like Christopher and the Sopranos dealing with Paulie, you know? It's like, oh, you're robbing me blind, but what am I going to say, you know?
Yeah. All right, Blackthorn's going to be taken to Osaka, and he meets a Spaniard named Rodriguez, who is the one responsible for taking him there. He educates Blackthorn on some of the Japanese customs and lets him take control of the ship as they sail directly into a massive storm. The ship barely survives it, but Rodriguez goes overboard in the process.
Yeah, did you recognize this Lord Rodriguez here?
Not until I looked him up. There were a few people in these first couple episodes. I'm like, I know that guy. And yeah, I do know this guy.
So I know him as from the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight series, the Batman series, because he plays the mayor, Mayor Garcia. But he's also in later seasons of Lost. Like, I guess he's a prominent in that. So I guess that's where most people know him. But
he looks way different here. His hair is all white. He's got this big bushy beard, and he's got a mostly shaved head. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that he is another one of my instantly favorite characters. Just like,
this is a man with personality and a sea of people who are very buttoned up. I loved it.
And this crazy kind of like very overt Western Spaniard demeanor and presentation, but he's clearly embraced a lot of the Eastern philosophies in terms of just like going along and like being in the current of life. And it's what a great character. I hope we're not done with him. I can't imagine they spent so much time ingratiating him to the Englishman but I don't know. He's a great character, great early character.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't help but just think how insane it is to be in a storm like this in what is effectively a glorified rowboat. I mean, those waves, man.
Yeah, and the seemingly like... handle your ship and I like because yeah go, heading into the wave turning into the swell like that's like sailing 101 like I don't quite understand why this guy was resistant to it, like why
if he's supposed to be a good pilot
Like, I felt like there was something missing. Was he drunk? Was he following this philosophy of what was it?
Shukame.
Shukame. Yeah. To its like illogical. Like, I'm just going with the flow, man. The ocean wants me to go this way, and yeah,
I don't know, but yeah, he did seem reluctant to turn into the swell, which even I know is what you need to do when the waves are that big.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. Because, like, it's just taking these broadside. Like, you can see the waves going through the interior of the ship because it's got these massive windows. And it's just, like, knocking people over. Knocks his own dumbass overboard.
Yep.
And as soon as the engine gets his hand on the rudder, then, like, suddenly it seems like it's okay. So, like, I wasn't quite... There must be... Also, I gathered that, like, in these first two episodes, they cover roughly the first third of the book.
Oh, wow.
So clearly they are rushing through to get to the important parts so they can take their time with the later parts of the story. But there has to be something we're missing because, like, it's this big question mark with Rodriguez. Why was he suicidal in the storm? Did he get drunk? Was he, like, so devoted to the Spanish cause that the Portuguese paid him to kill the Anjan before he even makes it to shore?
I don't know.
Not clear to me.
Yeah. After the storm, they go ashore. Yabushige takes Blackthorn to see if they can find Rodriguez. And they do, but he's a long way down off a cliff in rough water. And Blackthorn's going to go down after him, but they won't let him. Instead, he challenges Yabushige to go get him. And he does, though he barely survives the climb and is almost forced to kill himself in the process.
It's funny how Yabushige sees this as a ploy of, like, the Westerner testing him and testing his manhood. And, like, no, Blackthorn, it's like, this is entirely accidental. He's following his customs and demands. And, like, you know, like, that's like sailors, as much as possible, don't leave each other behind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're like have a horror of drowning in the sea. So he's like, and also the man's skilled, he should be but like Yabushige sees this as like, obviously he's trying to show him up in front of his men.
Yeah.
And
he can't turn down this challenge.
And like Blackthorn kind of instinctively knows that and plays the part. Like as soon as he realizes he like stands like he's a teacher looking at a student going through a very grueling testing protocol. It's interesting how he instinctually plays some of these power games so well.
Yeah, it's a big teaching scene for both of these characters, actually, because Blackthorn's going to learn a lot about the Japanese people here with their sense of honor, the way that they face death, especially this Yabushige guy who we've been shown is a student of death. And so, you know, he faces it pretty articulately, I'd say.
Yeah, he's like, you know, like Rodriguez says, like choosing your own manner of death, like, you know, what more can you ask for than that? But just as he's about to commit very hasty seppuku, he gets slapped with a rope in his face and his men save his life.
Yeah. Is Yabushige earning any respect from Blackthorn here? Or is this just simply surprise, like bewilderment on Blackthorn's part?
I think that yes, that like, so when he gets to the top, like Blackthorn bows to him and Yabushige kind of chuckles at like what's going on here. I think so. I think that like I would respect this guy for putting himself in that kind of risk in front of his men when he didn't have to. He could have ordered, like, and I think Blackthorn understands that he could have ordered any of his underlings to do that. Probably would have cost him to lose face, but the guy who's like putting his image of himself above his own life, I think Blackthorn really respects, because I don't think it's something he would do.
No,
Blackthorn seems above all a survivor, and there is some kind of like awe and respect that like, or not just awe, but like the possibility of like a whole people that view death this way and life this way, like what are the possibilities of that?
Yeah,
you know, like a truly alien way of looking at things.
Absolutely. And then, you know, Yabushige is adhering to that like sense of honor, but it also, like I said, he's a greedy opportunist. We just saw in the previous scene how he's willing to not directly but indirectly stab his own lord in the back if he thinks he has an advantage or could get one in the future. That's what makes him one of the most interesting characters to me, is he's got a lot of seemingly seeming like conflicts within him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's trying to serve two masters here, which, you know, goes into the next scene, I guess. Where Torunaga asks Mariko to be his trusted translator when Blackthorn arrives, because he believes Blackthorn could turn the tide for him, and he doesn't trust anybody else to translate for them.
Yeah, and we're also like a little bit more of the mystery of Mariko. That's been, you know, 14 years since the death of her father. There's something shameful about that, because she wanted to follow it, but like also from Torunaga's perspective, he revered the man, like really looked up to him.
And she wasn't permitted to die with him, which is what they say, which I think
robbed her of her purpose.
Well, it feeds back into that previous scene with Fuji, right? Like, you really understand now, oh, she's in the exact same predicament that she's putting this woman in. It's not just she has this like cultural understanding of the pain. She feels it herself because she's in the same situation.
So what is Torunaga promising when he says, I'll restore you to your purpose? Does that mean that he's going to give her permission to die? Does that mean that she'll get permission to remarry? Does that mean, like, I'm not exactly sure.
She's already remarried, right?
Oh, you're right. She is remarried.
We don't know that yet, but yeah.
What is her purpose that he's restoring her to? Or is he just saying, I'm going to give you a greater purpose than the shitty one that, you know, you got? Like, because her husband doesn't seem doesn't seem like a happy marriage at all.
No. Yeah, we'll talk about that in the next episode. But I think that's it. It's he's going to give her a new purpose.
And also, I think they're like kind of setting up Yobushiba and Shiga and this Mariko as kind of like, and maybe a lot of like the Iron Fist too, is they're showing like all the people that Torunaga has around him and all the reasons they have to betray him and all the reasons they have to be loyal to him. And I, you know, as a story enjoyer, I look at this and I'm like, one of these people will betray him. And like, I would say Yobushiga seems like the obvious one, so he cannot be the one. So like, sure. Does Iron Fist betray him? Does Mariko betray? Like, these are all interesting possibilities. And again, if you know the answer, keep it to yourself.
Don't be that guy or gal. Hiramatsu being the one to betray him, perhaps unknowingly. We'll see later. I don't know if he's the sharpest tool in the shed. We've talked about it a little bit, but
yeah, like he can't, like he doesn't see, he thinks that his lord's leading the whole clan to dishonor, and he's like doing something that he thinks is going to help his lord, but he doesn't fully. Yeah, like I said, betray can mean a lot of things.
Absolutely, yeah, you could inadvertently betray someone.
Yeah. Do it for the right reasons, but do the wrong action for the right reasons, you know.
Yeah, like Todayashi, right? Like, or Tadayoshi. He really
he
messed
was brave,
up,
but
he
was loyal.
Right?
But he put his lord behind the eight ball. Yeah.
So Blackthorn refuses to give in to the unseen power of nature, which Rodriguez is describing to him. So Rodriguez shows him the rudder that he found on his ship, which details their mission to pirate and plunder. Rodriguez plans to turn him in when they arrive in Osaka, which they do shortly after, and he's brought before Torunaga and bows low. The episode ends.
I love that, because, like, you know, as soon as Rodriguez shows that he's got the rudder, like, Blackthorn's instantly going to murder him, but Rodriguez is a step ahead. He's got the pistol.
Yeah.
Which is also a nice little bookend from the first scene, where Blackthorn gives the captain a pistol to kill himself. And then Blackthorn tries to kill a captain, and the pistol says, I thought that was an interesting way to start and stop the episode. And, you know, like I said, it's extremely, like, as horrific as the boiling scene was, I thought Tadayoshi's seppuku party and how just, like, bloodless it all is just so, it's hard to comprehend putting yourself in a position like that. Holding your newborn, like, this baby's not even a year old, and you're going to kill it, and then yourself, and end your blood. Like, that's insane. That seems insane.
To me, it seems objectively insane. Like,
but then you look, you know, it's like, I always, like, anytime I think something like that, I think of, like, something from my culture that looks at, like, the electric chair. That's an insane thing to do.
To you're not cook doing a person it with electricity. No. But we as society are like, and we get and we watch it, and it's like there's this ritual, and you put the hut, and you like that's an insane way to roll.
Doom scrolling. That's insane.
That's insane too. But we but you don't ever think about it that way. So
right.
I don't know. Every time I see something ugly in another culture, I think, what's ugly in my culture? And a lot of ugly shit in our culture, to be honest. A lot of beautiful things too, but yeah, the seppuku is just really hard to wrap your heart around, your head and heart around. And then,
speaking of hearts,
yes, let's talk about that.
There's this voice over here. I think it's from Tornaga, who's talking about every man having three hearts, one in his mouth for the world to know, another in his chest just for his friends, and a secret heart buried deep where no one can find it. And that is the heart a man must keep hidden if he wants to survive. I could not help but pair this with the two hearts that
you have to.
Mariko, explains that she has. It makes me wonder, do men have three hearts and women have two, or do women have three hearts as well? And like you were talking about, there could be some betrayal on the horizon.
Yeah, and she doesn't say I have two hearts. She says I have more than one heart. So I think you're like it's even a stronger association with this three-hearted approach. And also, like, so
she
here's
only
something
describes two.
We talked about, like, we talked, I think it was off the podcast, where, you know, we're both kind of going this blind. I did a little bit more reading and like the cultural stuff and background than you have. But like one thing I'm still unclear on, or I guess I found surprising, is the dual role Christianity plays in this culture. Where like it's accepted enough that people are able to openly worship, and these priests are walking around, and like there's this not this extreme outside of phobia, at least where it comes to the Spaniards and the Portuguese, but also they're oppressed enough to be rounded up and killed without any kind of trial or reason. And like even like where the one villager tries to like intervene for Blackthorn, he gets beheaded. My understanding was like he can get beheaded because he's Christian. He got beheaded because he annoyed the samurai and was getting in the way of his official business. So it's like I was very surprised at how open to Christianity the Japanese people seem to be overall. Like it's not they're not seen as like a cultural threat. It seemed as a kind of curiosity or a eccentricity, but yeah, it also is oppressed as well.
I can't tell if that is for the sake of greed, if they see the extreme wealth coming in from these Catholics and they embrace the religion because the wealth is also coming in.
Oh, and maybe the people in prison are the ones that are like the Father Domingo, who are like righteous, like we're in it for the souls, and we see how corrupt and gross, and they're maybe speaking out in the streets, and they're like political prisoners more than religious prisoners.
Yeah, could be. But yeah, we'll get more into that next episode. It's kind of the end of this episode. I am curious to see if Torunaga has this third heart that we have not yet seen, and actually does want to become Shogun.
That's the thing the whole reasons I had that thought of like maybe he's protesting a bit too much, or he's going to warm up to the idea of being a Shogun is if this is a universal truth, and I think the novel and the show is wanting us to believe that, then what is Torunaga's secret heart?
And we've seen the first two displayed. I mean, the first one is displayed in the meeting with the other regents. The second one is displayed sort of with the heirs. Guardian, maid, I don't know what they call him. But he has not revealed his third heart. I think that's for us to try and decipher.
And especially since, like, I would not characterize John Blackthorne as a good man.
No.
He's an adventurer. He's an opportunist. He's a war profiteer and a warmonger. And since it seems like him and Torunaga are kind of simpatico in these first two, like, is that telling me something about Torunaga too? Or is that going to eventually kind of whereas like Torunaga is going to be disgusted at John Blackthorne's like bedrock lack of morals? Or will John Blackthorne discover a bedrock of morals? Or will Torunaga? There's a lot of sly questions I think the show's asking us. I can really see why this is well regarded material.
Yeah, so far so good.
Well, that's going to be the episode. We're going to stop here, and just in case, like, you know, people consume the episodes in different orders, we'll split the two podcasts, even though they're kind of presented as a unit. No feedback this week because we were dealt, speaking of the Hand of Fate, a brutal hand in that Shogun had two episodes of very long, intricate storytelling at the same, and we're supposed to podcast on the same day that they saw fit to release a three-hour Dune movie. We're going to be working like an 18-hour day today, so we don't, we're literally up against hard time limits, but do not hesitate to send us feedback. Shogun at Bald Move. I do want to please ask that people keep advanced. Like, I realize that there's an entire novel and lightly historicized events that the answers for all these questions are probably contained there. Me and Jim don't want to know it, and I don't think most of the viewers want to know it either. So help us have a pristine viewer experience by not sending us in a ton of spoilers. And I don't, like, a lot of people are being help, like, try to be helpful with explanations, but they're essentially just telling us what's going to happen next episode. I don't, I want to avoid that. And I might even be willing to not do feedback this season if it becomes a problem. So, help keep us uncontaminated from the outside barbarians by preserving our ignorance of the book and historical details of this. But yeah, anything else you want to know as far as like illuminating things we're not too sure about that are not going to be spelled out to us in the beginning of time? If you got some background in Japanese, you just have some viewpoints as a first-time watcher, love all that stuff. Shogun at baldmove.com. Follow along with the other stuff we're doing. Our social media is at baldmove. And then finally, if you'd like to support us and get ad-free feeds and bonus content, like our OTC show, we're currently talking about Apple TV's Constellation, Netflix's Blue Eye Samurai. The next one, I'll be talking about the Avatar, The Last Airbender adaptation. We could use your support, support.baldmove.com for more information about that. That's it. On to the next episode. We'll see you there. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jay.
Later.